There's a very excellent book by Annie Besant for those who have a Christian background on esoteric Christianity. But I think for those of us who have been raised in the Christian tradition, happily my own Christian background was not where I had to accept that Jesus died for our sins. It was a much more liberal Christian background, fortunately. But for those that do have a Christian background, it seems to me that we look at all of these ideas from a metaphorical point of view, that they represent an allegory of human existence and should not be taken literally in any way. Jesus as Gautama, as Krishna, are paradigms, if I can use that horrible word, of the perfected human, and the stages towards that have been given in a variety of ways. Therefore, we are not literalists, and I think every theosophist who has considered the Christian tradition will agree that it needs an interpretation from an inner point of view of what the message is so far as our humanity is concerned.
So what is the actual, how would we interpret that particular part of Christian doctrine that Jesus died for our sins?
I wouldn't say that that's an absolutely essential part of Christian doctrine is my main point.
Happens if you get a typical Christian on the street who comes to you and says, you know, what's your perspective as a theosophist on the fact that that Jesus died for our sins? I mean, you could say we don't interpret this literally, but then what do you give to deepen perhaps his understanding of that?
I think you're being asked the question, Diana.
Well, I was about to answer it.
Pardon all our shortcomings.
I think it's a highly personal thing for each theosophist and each Christian, how you would interpret that at a psychological level or at a symbolic level. I think to me, you may not like this, but I think to me the idea of Jesus dying for my sins would be that, now this is highly personal, but for me it would be that through Jesus there's an absolutely certain connection with my higher self, and that is to say that no matter what I've done, no matter what sins I've committed, through Jesus I have that connection, I have that possibility of being regenerated. So I think that's the way I would answer that question if it were a Christian answering it, an Orthodox Christian asking the question. That would be really the beginning of a discussion more than anything.
It's not a discussion meeting.
No, but if I were talking to someone who asked that question.
Mm-hmm. I'll get on to the next question. But this is a far more simpler one, but quite pertinent to some individuals. If one wants to study theosophy at a centre like Tridona or Adia, can the panelists please explain what the difference between the two centres is, including perhaps advantages of each?
Well, I wouldn't talk in terms of advantages. Both are beautiful centres. There are other centres also. There is St. Michael's Centre in Holland, and there is the Kuranda Center now in Australia. The Manor Center has sometimes some programs. Each has its own special quality and atmosphere. In Adyar, the School of the Wisdom courses are generally rather long, sustained courses with often a single director. For instance, when Ravi Ravindra came there, he took the entire course from January to March. When Joy comes there, she is going to conduct the course from beginning of February to middle of March, isn't it? End of March, 2 months. So we have these longer courses at Adia. In Crotona, there are many more shorter courses. The climate is entirely different, the costs are different. So by making inquiries, you can find out what the advantages are. this question of advantage or disadvantage is all relative. If you like a warm climate, it may be of advantage to be in Adyar. If you don't, it may be better to be somewhere else. But I think all of them have a very beautiful setting, and there is something worthwhile.
Thank you. The secret doctrine teaches the movement from oneness to duality or manifestation, and now from duality back to oneness. After the universe becomes one, it becomes duality again. What is the point? Why must we go with it?
Well, we have no choice.
I hope this will inspire many of you to read some of the outstanding works of Dr. I.K. Thamini. In a very simple illustration, he points out how a white light passing through a prism splits into different colors, and you see that all that beauty is in that color. So the manifestation of diversity, which is basically a unity, reveals all the richness of that unity. And the whole purpose of being in contact with that diversity is to learn to see all the glory of the unity, because unity is not homogeneity. Unity is a composite of wonderful diversities of various kinds.
Uh-huh. I think one can add to that also that not to see it as duality, but a polarization which takes place within the one. And it is, Radha said, in order to see that, to come awake to it, could we say also that it's therefore the purpose lies in the development of consciousness, in the furtherance of that awareness that one is all of that that is comprehended within the one. The one is still there, even though the diversity has been revealed.
And since we are all part of that manifestation, it is a form of grand self-awareness, different units of that one becoming aware of the totality of that unity.
Thank you. What are the marks of an evolved soul?
Well, here is the example before you. No, sorry, go on. Seriously.
You?
No.
What are the marks?
How do you recognize an advanced soul?
Evolved soul.
Evolved soul. What are the marks?
By their acts you shall judge them?
Yes.
You shall know them?
Well, how can we judge the value of a teacher who often attracts a large following, example Sai Baba and many others?
Oh, the previous question is over, is it?
No. I think we were not going to get anywhere with that.
Yes, we are.
We are. We're okay. Go on.
I would like to suggest that those marks can be recognized only by a person who is only by persons in the plural who are perceptive enough to see the marks. As you know, there have been great spiritual beings who have not only been not recognized but opposed, betrayed, because those particular persons couldn't see the marks of spiritual greatness in them. So it's not because of the marks that we know them, but because we are sensitive to see what there is. And if so, then perhaps the question will not be asked. If there is purity within us, we will respond to purity of the soul somewhere else. I'm not saying purity of the same order, intensity, etc. But there must be some purity within us. is it not said that blessed are the pure in heart because they will see and they shall see God or something like that? Similarly, it is the pure heart which responds to the purity in the highly evolved person. It is the gentleness within us which appreciates the gentleness there, etc., etc. One can go through the whole gamut. So I would say the marks will be instantaneously recognized by anyone who makes himself capable of such recognition.
Just regarding evolution anyway, this idea of spiritual advancement, what I've noticed, apart from the greatest of the great, the ones that Radha is referring to, what I've noticed is that there's a sort of a paradox in each of us. In some ways, we're really quite advanced, and in other ways, we're very primitive. So I've stopped looking for advanced souls. I know one shouldn't anyway. But I've stopped trying to find the embodiment of the advanced soul. And now I've just taken delight in noticing these amazing qualities in certain people. And then they have amazing faults as well.
How can we judge the value of a teacher who often attracts a large following? Example, Sai Baba and many others.
Could you repeat that to the...
How can we judge the value of a teacher who often attracts a large following? Example, Sai Baba and many others.
Certainly not by simply the numbers that are being attracted. I think there is a resonance to truth. If there is truth in another, and we find that truth within us, there is a call, as it were, a resonance, a rapport, an understanding. I think that one also needs to see, is there a kind of self-inflation, an ego inflation on the part of the teacher who thrives on the adulation of the followers? And very often this is what comes about, isn't it? An emphasis on self and on oneself, an emphasis on I am the teacher, rather than that gentleness and humility and purity. So certainly it cannot be judged by a certain charisma, which seems to be the popular word in that regard, of someone who attracts very large followings, who can perform all kinds of perhaps psychic tricks, some of the what HPB calls the lower siddhis, the psychic ability to do this, that, and the other. What is the teaching? Not who is the teacher, but what is the teaching? What is being said that inspires, that awakens within us our own deep response of living a better life, of living in a certain manner that leads us to a deeper and deeper understanding, compassion, love, service?
I'd like to add to that, perhaps we don't have to evaluate at all, but if we do, there are certain criteria. If there is somebody who is making money, profiting from the following, there's something wrong. I would say that we can evaluate that person rather low on the scale, because no real religious or spiritual teacher would try to gain either a large number of disciples or money or travel in private aeroplanes and all that, which some of these people do. Second thing is, if there is anyone who doesn't encourage people to an ethical life, I would say there is something wrong. Because without a foundation of true morality, not social morality which may be popular at that time, but real morality based on unselfishness and absence of ego, is the foundation of all true religious and spiritual life. So if there is somebody who doesn't encourage this, then I would again evaluate that person rather low on the scale. Similarly, if there is someone who whose life, example, or teachings tends to create divisions, I would not evaluate that person high. So there are certain criteria which we can use. From the theosophical point of view also, we can say that any true teacher must try to awaken the intelligence in people and not make them dumb.
What is wrong with the Ellis Bailey organizations?
As far as I know, the organizations are probably all right, but that is not the Theosophical Society. The organization is, I don't know what's wrong with them, with the organizations, and the question is, what's wrong with their organizations? We're not in a position to judge that, but this is the Theosophical Society.
I entirely agree with Joy. We are not concerned with either Alice Bailey's organization or various other people's organizations. Why should we say whether they are wrong or right? We don't know enough about them. We are not in them to make any comments about it. But as far as I am concerned, the Alice Bailey teachings, as they are called, don't appeal to me, because there is far too much emphasis on the on information. I don't consider them anything more than information. I believe that most of our theosophical leaders did not accept the statement that they all came from a very high source, the Tibetan master, as she says. And I also, to the extent that I have read it, find it very difficult to accept, or cannot accept, that they came from such a source. But filling the head with more and more information about the race or whatever it is doesn't really help anybody. It is by going deeper into things and being able to perceive with that at that intuitive level for oneself, which can only be done by purification, the purging of one's the mind of the impurities, etc., that one can really come to understand more and have greater wisdom. Therefore, the emphasis on volumes of information to me doesn't seem too compatible with the theosophical approach. There are, of course, various statements which each individual must examine and find out for himself or herself whether it is appeals or doesn't. But I don't care for some of her statements. For instance, she says or indicates that it's good to become a vegetarian in order to learn self-restraint or something like that, to control one's desire for certain types of food. But once you learn to control yourself, it doesn't matter what you eat. Well, that doesn't appeal to me, because I think the basis is the sacredness of life, the unity of life. And it's not a matter of restraint. The Buddhists also use some arguments like this. They say that the Buddhist monk who takes his begging bowl must eat whatever is put into that bowl. But the fact is, the population knows very well that they would like some fish or meat to be put in it. If they knew that the monks didn't want it, they wouldn't put it there. So it becomes an excuse to violate the principle of harmlessness, which is the first of the five precepts.
I certainly agree with Rada. When one looks at the Alice Bailey teachings, one has to judge them on their own merit. They've never had any appeal to me, mainly because she's so verbose, for one thing. I find it very too many words. I agree, I cannot accept the source to which it's attributed, and for that for a variety of reasons. But nothing, in my opinion, approaches the genuine theosophical teachings. And there are many divergences, if one is really familiar with the fundamental teachings of the theosophical philosophy, there are many divergences. And I think one has to make these judgments. But if one wants to follow that path, there are organizations for it.
Yes.
But to turn the Theosophical Society into an Alice Bailey study group or into an Alice Bailey society is contrary to the uniqueness of the Theosophical Society, just as to turn the Theosophical Society into the Ramana Maharshi Society or even the Buddhist Society or what esoteric Christian society. The Theosophical Society has its own uniqueness. The Theosophical worldview is unique. And I think when one examines that, it's not that one can't examine a whole realm of other teaching, other teachings, if you like, of course. And that is the freedom that each of us has individually. But when it comes to turning a lodge or the society into a particular teaching, then we are not true to the basic purposes of the society itself. As individuals, we're certainly free to study whatever. Nobody has an index against which you can't read the books on a certain index, as it were. So as individuals, we pursue that. For myself, I have not found anything that touches the depth and the probing and the inquiry that is encouraged within the society. And let us keep the society in its uniqueness.
I have a lot of respect for the fact that Rada and Joy have both examined the writings of Alice Bailey in order to have their own individual evaluations. Unfortunately, I've noticed amongst members scattered here and there all over the world a tendency to whisper amongst themselves and say, "Ooh, she's an Alice Baileyite, you know," without ever having studied them for themselves, the teachings for themselves, and they'll tend to put down Alice Bailey on a second-hand basis and really hurt the feelings of theosophists who are members of both organizations, or at least students of both sets of teachings. I wish we could avoid that.
No, but I think the point Joy has made is an important point. The individual member is free to study or follow Alice Bailey or Ramana Maharshi or Sai Baba or any old thing. But a theosophical lodge has to fulfill the purposes for which the Theosophical Society exists. It cannot make itself into the instrument for something else, whatever it is, Aurobindo or Alice Bailey or whatever it is. The lodge does not have that freedom. The lodge represents the society in its place, and it must work for the aims of the society and have the character of the society. As members, people can do what they like, except try to bring their views into the lodge and convert it into something else.
I have many friends with a background in science, and when querying our theosophical teachings, have, through their knowledge of mathematics, tried to disprove my understanding that we have all had thousands of lives, and usually at intervals of several hundred years apart. Their reckoning is that from the birth of mankind to the present, world population doesn't equate. Can someone please clarify this for me?
Very briefly, this is the question that is asked, I suppose, of every speaker that has ever appeared on the theosophical platform in recent years. How do you account for the population explosion? Which presupposes a number of things, which I frankly find one cannot presuppose. That is, that there is a limited number
of egos in incarnation at any one time, or that there's a limited number of egos for this particular manvantara. I don't know about that. And therefore, it's a premise that I personally cannot accept. Secondly, it presupposes that we know all about the mechanics of reincarnation. And I personally feel that as further one examines the whole concept of reincarnation, the less one comes to know about some of its inner workings. And so I think we need to recognize that there is much that we do not know. A, we have not been told. B, we have not really examined for ourselves. Is there a limited number? Have we reached some explosion? In the last century, the Malthusian doctrine was very prominent at one period, and we were going to be so overpopulated. That was proven false, that there are cycles in population, and that there are periods when there are fewer people, perhaps, in incarnation than in other periods. One has to examine this over a very, very long period of time. So I think that this scientific attitude is often based on false premises, which no scientist really should do if they're truly scientific in their approach to a subject. And secondly, for us to say, well, yes, but there are only 60 billion egos within this particular cycle, and we haven't reached that period yet, 600 billion or whatever it is. I never can remember numbers like that. I have all I can do to keep my checkbook in balance, and I assure you it doesn't reach those figures. But I think that one has to examine the question from the point of view of really what underlies this whole concept of reincarnation and how it operates, and look at what are the premises that are being brought up which are false in themselves.
I suppose it's like going to a picture theater where at any time you may have 400 or so, mm-hmm. whereas the world has got a huge population.
Yes. Hmm.
Radha spoke on ever new theosophy. What does the panel think about our historical theosophy, non-ever new, relation to the ever new theosophy?
Well, there's no reason why historical theosophy should not have been ever new.
That's right.
Next question, please.
Yes.
If you really listened to Radha's talk this morning, you would realize that it is theosophy, whether historical or whatever, that is ever new.
This is a rather long one. When we try to do the right thing in life, live for right ways, and make the right decisions, we occasionally are lucky enough to receive encouraging little hints that some particular action or decision was the right choice. However, occasionally we may act in a certain way that we know well is right. For instance, choosing the harmless option rather than a more selfish route. Yet everything goes wrong. Obstructions occur, and our best efforts are thwarted. Why should this be, and what can we do in the face of such opposition? And in brackets here, a special example clarified for the speakers. We tried to move from lifestyle. Oh, I won't go into that. Sorry.
No, we don't need that. Well, I'll begin the discussion. I think we take too short a view, if I can put it that way. I realize that from the point of view of economics, if one has invested in something and then you've lost everything, you're faced with certain situations. It is said that the good always suffer, you know. Do we look at it from the point of view of a very short period of time, of one incarnation, for example? Here is the very virtuous person, the very good person, who is suffering, who is stricken with some incurable disease, and so on. within that short period of time? Or do we look at it from the point of view of the ego, the soul, who may be experiencing something that is strengthening, giving courage, giving bravery? How many people, under the most difficult of circumstances, have risen to tremendous challenge of becoming really exemplars of wisdom and strength and beauty and saintliness, courage in the world? So how do we react to these? Is it what happens to us, or what we do with what happens to us? I think we tend to see karma as a kind of tit-for-tat game. I've been good, dear Lord, and so now don't strike me down, sort of thing. But perhaps that very striking down is what gives me courage to stand up again, to move forward again, to have greater sympathy, greater understanding for my fellow beings, for other beings who are also suffering. It may be that very thing that I need to give me the compassion and the understanding and the growth that will transform my consciousness into the kind of awareness of all that happens in the world and the tragedies in the world, and helps me to be less self-centered, less greedy, less petty, less self-centered in and concerned with my own being.
You see this kind of thing exemplified in the lives of many spiritually great people. I suppose most of us here are familiar with the life of Annie Besant. She didn't take the easy option. As you probably know, at a time when the Christian world was very rigid, she went through great suffering, not because she was not religious. She says she was religious to her fingertips. And because she was so deeply devoted and religious, she studied the Bible very carefully. She made a columns and wrote the gospel story according to Mark, Luke, etc. And she found the discrepancies and in all earnestness asked why there were these differences, because it was all supposed to be literal truth. And she was told that she mustn't ask any questions. Well, she proceeded. She lost her home. She was disapproved of by the whole of society. In those days, a woman living alone was considered an immoral woman for various reasons. It ended up in her losing her little daughter, who was torn away from her arms. They said that she wasn't worthy of bringing up a child. She underwent so much abuse and humiliation and economic hardship, but she rose out of it. The other day, there was the discussion on spiritual alchemy, and only supporting what Joy said, she rose out of it as an extraordinary person. Her daughter has given evidence of the fact that her mother, by losing one child, learned to be so loving that she became a mother to thousands. And it is a fact. In India, there are tens of thousands of people who received that kind of tenderness, kindness, and help from her. They all regarded her as their mother. So in all these difficulties, there are possibilities at the spiritual level.
The questioner has apparently tried to move from stock farming to some other kind of farming. Seems to me that that's an extraordinarily courageous thing to do in New Zealand, particularly. Perhaps this person is the pioneer of a whole new movement and a several hundred year cycle in New Zealand's development. It makes me think of the nuclear situation in the world. I don't know if you realize what an impact New Zealand and Australia and now recently Japan have had on this whole issue. I've been following all the press clippings in France and around the world, and New Zealand and Australia have really led the world, amongst other countries too, but have really made an impact. And I thought just 10 years ago it would be impossible for two small countries to do that. It's been very moving to see that. So I would say that this stock farming person should take heart. They've been very brave.
It seems that in nature, particularly the plant kingdom, the beautiful are often frail and fragile, and the strong, vigorous species are ugly, aggressive, hurtful, and have nothing to offer. I realize everything is beautiful in its own way, of course, and it is a subject thing, but perhaps a few examples would be thistles, chickweed, convolvulus, blindweed, weed, and sorrel. None of these have attractive or perfumed flowers, nor provide food for ourselves or animals, but can quickly overrun, smother, and kill beautiful but less robust flowers and shrubs. Why should this be?
Well, beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Yes.
What do we mean by a weed? There are no weeds. When something is inconvenient to us, we call it a weed. A person who finds rose bushes coming out of the land where he wants to cultivate corn will consider the rose bushes as weeds. So the whole idea that certain plants are ugly and certain animals are no good, etc., so all our conditioned response to these things. From the ecological and environmental point of view, people have again and again discovered that the things which were considered objectionable had their own role and place in the total biosphere, in the ecology of the world. There was a time when in China they considered sparrows and birds like that as pests. And they instructed the population to kill them and offered rewards. So vast numbers of these birds were killed. And they were supposed to prevent the corn from growing. But they found that as a result of this mass massacre, there were more problems because the worms which were being eaten by these birds multiplied without restraint. So their problem was worse. So I think with our short-sighted, conditioned viewpoint, we mustn't come to these sort of conclusions about what is good and what is bad and which is a weed and so on. Let us recognize the limitations in our own perception.
Is there a symbolic level of that question, I wonder? I mean, isn't it true that in life, 9 people out of 10 will trample over the person next to them in an emergency to get to an exit or when they're panicked? I mean, isn't it true that the masses of us tend to work on our basic instincts, like the weeds that we're not allowed to call weeds now? I think that's the nature of evolution, that everything's moving to a point, and it's only at the tip that the beautiful and the delicate here are at the top, and they are vulnerable in a sense from the masses. So I think we need to think about that one symbolically too, but I haven't had enough time to think it through.
The weak need the strong and the strong need the weak.
When I was in Australia a few years ago, somebody spoke about the animal called the Tasmanian devil and said, it's a horrible creature, it's ugly, etc. I said, why is it horrible? Because it kills other creatures without any reason. I said, but then it's not doing anything worse than the Queen of England or her family who go around shooting thousands of creatures for no reason, just because they like it. So why do we have different scales like this?
There was a man who was trying to cultivate a beautiful green lawn, and he kept having these dandelions appearing. And he got furious because he wanted this, you know, like a croquet lawn or a golf green. He got really mad, so he wrote to the Ministry of Agriculture, this wasn't in New Zealand, and he said, what can I do to get rid of these dandelions? And they wrote back, Dear Sir, we suggest you learn to love them.
So you agree there are no weeds?
Yes. So I agree there are no weeds.
Khalil Gibran had a poem in the Prophet, which was, I learned tolerance from the intolerant. I learned kindness from the unkind. And I learned silence from the talkative. And I'm grateful to all my teachers. I think that's a lesson in everything. Do we hide our light under a bushel? Would it be of value to have our leading exponents of theosophy involve themselves more in world affairs with non-theosophists who also work for humanity in various ways, philosophical, religious, political, or social?
Well, I mean, I'm happy to first go there. As the International Secretary of the Theosophical Order of Service, historically, of course, our leaders were especially active in humanitarian fields and even political activities, and they brought about great renown or great disapprobrium for the Theosophical Society, not because they spoke in the name of the Theosophical Society, but simply because, by their very fame, they were associated with the Theosophical Society. That seems to be a two-edged sword in that sense. Personally, I would like to see our theosophical leaders take more of a stand, not as official position holders in the organization, but as individuals these days. That's an opener.
I think all the leaders and all thoughtful theosophists or members of the Theosophical Society are taking a hand in political, economic, and social, and all other affairs. Because what is fundamental is what happens at the mental level. All action begins inside the mind, and that is what we are working on, that there should be the right state of mind, and in which case, if that can be brought about, then everything else will be all right. This is the reason why no religious teacher, any great religious teacher has ever taught people how to organize their society or manage their finances. They only talked about the inner condition, because the outer action comes from that inner condition.
I think the question also again is indicative of a kind of apathy that can set in. We want our leaders to take a position so that we can all follow. And we can say, yes, the president of the Theosophical Society is doing this or doing that. And then we can sit back. I think it's indicative of an apathy that tends to grip us. What are each one of us doing in terms of any constructive and responsible efforts to bring about that kind of interior change that ultimately results in exterior change in the world, the kind of change of which Radha just spoke, to bring about that? What is each one of us engaged in? This leaves each one of us free, and every member is free, to be involved in educational reform, for example. We immediately think of the political scene. Each one of us is here in a free country, whether we're New Zealanders or Australians or Americans. We each have the right to vote. Do we take advantage of that right as a duty to express our views towards one or another candidate? We ourselves get the governments we deserve, and I think that we have to recognize that. There are many other areas: prison reform, help to the underprivileged, educational reform, restructuring of society generally. What is each one, not waiting for some leader to say,
for Radha to say, now we're all going to, you know, free this country or that country, whatever it may be, in the political sphere. But we have an individual responsibility, A, to bring ourselves into that condition where the mind can really send forth or be that kind of consciousness that can raise the consciousness of humanity, and B, take an active role in whatever area may appeal to us, we may feel ourselves moved. I was for some years a teacher, and therefore I happened to be very interested in educational reform, a little less so in political reform, because I think it is education that brings about ultimately political reform and social reform. And so I may give effort, my efforts in that field, but I think let's not look just to the leaders of the society. Let's look to ourselves. What are we doing individually with our thoughts, with our feelings, with our understanding, and moving out into the community as responsible individuals with a sense of the ethical values, moral values, that should characterize the true theosophist.
I'd like to suggest that the questioner, the person who asked that question, might like to get hold of the Theosophist magazine that comes from Adyar. I lament the fact that so few people subscribe to that, but Radha has a Watchtower column it's been running for, 100 years or more. The Watchtower column is where Radha comments, or the person she invites comments on anything that they wish to comment on. Often Radha makes comments on the world scene, and they're very hard-hitting. It's my favourite... my favourite part of Radha is the Watchtower, so I recommend that to you for your consideration.
Thank you for listening to that.
Would you mind one or two questions while I talk?
Unless somebody is particularly wanting to ask questions, that extra 5 minutes will probably help us all get dressed properly.
That's right, yes. I will close the meeting now and thank the speakers.
Thank you, Arun.
Bloody nice style. Thank you.